Hello, this is Roman Gabriel, and you are listening to The Grueling Truth.
Welcome to The Grueling Truth NFL Legends Show, brought to you by Gridiron Mo, a new interactive football app where you get to call what you think the offense or defense should do during a live NFL game and see what all other fans have called also. Check out Gridiron Mo at www.gridironmo.com. As always, I'm your host for The Legends Show, Mike Goodpasture. I want to welcome in my co-host, Matt Andruskavage.
Thanks, Mike. Excited to be here tonight, and we've got a very interesting guest, someone that I remember watching a lot, and looking forward to hearing what he's got to say.
All right. Our guest tonight played 13 years in the NFL, including three Pro Bowl appearances. Help us welcome to The Grueling Truth, Jerry Ball.
Hey, thank you. Thank you guys for having me. You know, glad to be here.
All right. Let's just start. When did you start playing football? Some of your early influences? Just touch a little there, maybe a little bit about your high school career.
Okay. Well, I'm from Beaumont, Texas, you know, at one time considered the pro football capital of the world, the Bubba Smiths, Mel Ford, the Jerry Levises, and the Joe Washingtons and all those type of guys are from the area, Bum Phillips, Louis Kelcher, Jimmy Johnson. So growing up down in what's known as the Golden Triangle, football is the culture, it's the way. And, you know, if you don't know how to do anything early, then you find out if you're going to be a football player. So grew up in that environment, great community, refinery town right there on the Gulf. Started playing football at 7, little league, and as I grew, I was a little bigger than the other kids. Middle school coach came and got me off the little team, and in the 6th grade put me on the 7th grade, and I always played 1 year in advance of my age. Ended up going to high school called Beaumont Hebert, merged with another school called Beaumont Westbrook that ended up winning the state championship, 5A state championship the first year of its existence. You know, we went through a little racial issue or issue where the federal court had to come in and force the integration. So that was a real exposure to, you know, politics and how it works, you know, being a kid. So went on to SMU, played during, you know, the days of what I would call Opponent Express 1 and 2. I actually finished my collegiate career at SMU before the death penalty, but, you know, was there right at the heels of it. So seeing that, I was drafted by the Lions and, you know, ended up playing 13 years, four teams, the Lions, Cleveland, the Raiders, and the Vikings.
Well, the Lions were not very good, to say the least, when you got there. Wayne Fonts took over during your second season. What was your relationship like with Coach Fonts?
Well, I tell you, Wayne Fonts, I mean, was such a great coach that, you know, we had enough confidence that myself and a couple of other players actually wrote a letter to Mr. Ford telling him that we felt that the team could definitely make progress, and Wayne was a solid leader. You know, the players loved him and would love to have him as the head coach. Mr. Ford heard us, and he gave us that opportunity, and immediately we became contenders. You know, and first year I was there with Darryl Rogers, every day I walked in, I thought I was in a philosophy class because we didn't do much with the X's and O's, but he had a lot of great, you know, philosophy and stories about war. So, you know, we spent a lot of time, you know, doing a lot of historical, I guess you say, orating from the coach versus the X's and O's.
All right, now 1991, you guys have been rough for the first few years you were there, but 91 had to be a special season in Detroit, probably the best season they've had since Bobby Lane was there in the late 50s. You want to tell us a little bit about that season?
You know, the 91 season, out of all of the time that I was there, was probably the most exciting, you know, for the organization, but for me as a player as well. And what most people really don't realize is that as a team, we actually had lost a lot of our starters that year. So we had a lot of guys that were, you know, we called backups that were in the starting role, and we found the right chemistry and we got on a roll. And I mean, and we was thumped the Cowboys in the regular season, then thumped them again in the playoffs pretty handily. And we really felt that we had a chance, you know, went to Washington and lost to them. I got hit with the chop block four games before the season was over there with the Jets. They said it was legal, but a chop block is an illegal block, you know, just for the tort and liability aspects of it. The league stood and said that they were behind. But so I didn't play the last four games, but if we would have beat the Redskins in the national championship, in the national conference, in the NFC, I would have had a chance to play in a Pro Bowl because I would have been able to have returned from the meteoric lateral injury.
I was wondering if you would talk about two players that I remember watching. One of my all-time favorites, Barry Sanders, and also a linebacker I liked a lot, Chris Spielman. What were they like as teammates?
Well, I think, you know, I'll start with Chris, you know, played on the same side of the ball with Chris. And, you know, Chris was probably one of the most intense guys that you're around. He was truly committed to the game. You know, the things that Chris did was extraordinary because, you know, his commitment was year-round, you know, even before. Now ball is somewhat year-round. You know, Chris was there, you know, be it, you know, working out or somewhere around football at all times, 12 months out of the year. You know, he kind of reminded you of, you know, the old guy like a Pete Rose it was in baseball. Full out, Harry hustle, every play, don't lay it on the line. If I lose an arm, I was losing my arm on my way to a tackle. That's, you know, real gritty guy. Barry, you know, you're talking about, you know, once in a lifetime to even see that for most people that have seen him play during that era. Very special, the humility that he had as a player, you know, made him an even greater person. Because, you know, most guys, and I believe, you know, when God chooses to bless people, that he chooses the right people to bless that way, because the skill set that he had, you know, was great. But, you know, who he was as a person and character and the way he carried himself on and off the field, that's where the exemplary character, you really separated him from everyone. Because it's real easy to be the great player on the field, you know, but you could be a kind of butthole off the field. There was never that on or off.
All right, so you played for, what, four or five teams in your NFL career. We're going to go ahead and fast forward a little bit so we can get to your business venture you're doing and some other things. But we'll fast forward to 1998. You're on the Vikings. Great season, 15-1, came up a little bit short. You were on a defensive line with a man named John Randall, who I think is one of the best defensive linemen to ever play the game. You want to talk a little bit about what it was like to play with him and maybe a little bit about the 98 season?
Yeah, I'll start with Johnny. You know, Johnny as a player, defensive lineman, you know, first of all, he's not real tall. When you really measure him against a lot of the defensive linemen that you would say, who are the great linemen? He's not going to be that. He's not that 6'4", 6'3", 6'5", defensive end with a lot of range. But in points of leverage and how he actually used a person's balance and his strength against them to create the great pass rush that you would see, you know, really showed me how to get it done at a level whereas, you know, technically a guy that's rushing on the outside is going to have a little bit more arm reach so that he can start touching the offensive tackle because you're playing in a perimeter game, so you work in more space. But Johnny was able to close the gap, and because he didn't have the wingspan, use inside moves on the outside that made him a prolific pass rusher. And when I came, you know, Johnny was mostly on the inside. And they told me, they say, Jerry, if you could hold up the middle and get us, you know, to a pass situation, you know, then we can kind of unleash Johnny on our side. So we started doing that. And then the next thing you know, shoot, Johnny was out there full time, you know, and they were able to kind of set the defense like they wanted and let that guy really go up and down the line and pick who he wanted to pick on, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, and I tell you a funny thing about him. Before the games, his pregame ritual, you know, he put on the eye black. But what's going on in the locker room is he goes to every guy that he can, and he'll touch you on your shoulders and your chest, and he say, "I'm taking your power. I'll take it." He's like, "I got your power. I got your power." You see guys in the locker room like, "Okay, shit, I don't know if this worked or not, so let me get some of my power back." So I gotta go back and, like, give me my power back, because whatever he was doing out there, they want it. So he's like, "If he's taking it, then I want some. Give it back to me. You can take his." That was one funny thing about his ritual. But full-out competitor. The 98 season, you know, that was a very great season, you know, for myself, the best team I've been on in terms of being competitive. You know, I played on some pretty good football teams, but I think that year we really did have the team that could have won it all. We were beating, you know, teams handily all year, you know, lose with a field goal at the end. I would tell you, you know, the Randy Mosses, Jake Reed, Chris Carters, Robert Smith, Randall McDaniels, Todd Stutzy, you know, and a host of others, Leroy Hoyes, role players, Harold Morrow, Mo Williams, you know, just on offense, you know, those guys gave us a real high-powered ability. And the defense, you know, I wouldn't say that we were world beaters, but, you know, we complimented our offense because we could keep teams anywhere around 13 to 15 points, 16 points, we could win the games because our offense could put up 17 to 21 points every game. So not because we didn't feel that we could be like a Baltimore Ravens, we just didn't have the personnel like they had from the front to the back. So we had to cover a lot of things in the defenses and the coverages. Never really got the secondary set like we wanted because, you know, guys like Orlando Thomas, who actually had ALS and recently passed, you know, he had been hurt off and on that year with his hamstring, so we couldn't get him back. Had guys kind of shuffled in off of the practice squad, but still we played well enough as a team, whereas we put ourselves in great positions to win all year. And then, you know, Randall came in and he started laying it up for Moss, and, you know, it was a great team.
Was there something that changed between the 97 and 98 season? You guys had a lot of the same players, like Ed McDaniel, Dwayne Rudd, you know, like you said, Orlando Thomas, Robert Griffith. What was it that brought it all together, that 98 season was really special even for the defense?
I'll say this, but I'm not saying it on the basis of, you know, being, you know, self-aware of my role. But I remember Denny Green on one broadcast said the difference in this team versus the last year was Jerry Ball. And they asked him, "Well, what is it?" He said, "Well, we had Jerry doing camp." In camp, I kind of took a leadership role, whereas the younger players, you know, we set a standard, and I would talk with them and tell them how we needed to practice and how our etiquette would be on the field. Meaning, if you drop the football, I don't care if you're a receiver or running back or DB, the ball is a value. So if a receiver went out and he dropped the ball, it wasn't no more leaving the ball on the ground and you running back to the huddle. No, you go get the ball. You're being paid to catch the ball. You go get it, you bring it back because it's of value. That's why you're here. And once we start understanding everybody's role, the other thing I started telling them about it, say, look, every day we come to practice, it's not going to be the best day for everyone every day to practice. So let's create pace setters so that at every position, the backer crew, D-line crew, receivers, O-line, we all have a pace setter that day. So that person that day is responsible for keeping everybody at the highest level so that it's never a drop-off in practice, even if it's not your best day.
if you just maintain and keep the level high when it comes to game time, it's easy to tap into it. And that was one of the things that we did. And then collectively as a team, we had the little jousting and jovial things going on in the locker room. So, like, if one guy came and attacked the offensive lineman, if the other offensive lineman didn't come to his rescue, then we jumped on it. And so you had is every group taking care of each other and built a real camaraderie. So that when it came time to really play on Sunday, oh, we're going to fight you. Okay, but we're going to stick together regardless, and we just built that within. And, you know, those were the little things that, you know, as a veteran player, you know, they brought me in to really kind of work with the younger guys that were on the line, because I still had a little young line. And like you said, Rudd, some of those guys, they were just learning the pro game. So that's one of the things that I brought. And then they brought in Chris Dolman as well. And Chris came in. And he helped guys kind of round out, you know, the longevity part of it, how to stay in the game, how to be a pro. So those were the things that I would think kind of really made us a little different those years, is that we started understanding how to play as a team, and we really put the selfishness aside for the greater good of the team.
All right. Now, you were a three-time Pro Bowler. You had a great career. I think you're one of the best interior defensive linemen in the decade of the 90s. Looking back, is there anything you would change about your career?
Well, you know, there's a couple things that, of course, if, you know, you could always say, oh, if I would have did this or that. I would have loved probably to stay in Detroit all my career. Not that I didn't enjoy the other teams as much as it is, you know, You want to be drafted by one team and have a relationship with the team, whereas you can start and finish with the same team. That's a great thing to me for any player.
Yeah,
that would be one thing. I was a holdout a couple of times, you know, but at the same time, I don't really regret it, but I do believe in discretion. We could have went at it different, both the team and I. Other than that, you know, I really have, you know, really no hard complaints. I've dealt with every owner on every team, so it wasn't like I didn't have the ear of the organization, because I really did have the ability of talking directly to the owners. And so those would be probably just, you know, two of the things that really probably would have been a want more than something I would have had to change.
I know that you'd like to let as many younger players or current players as possible know about how the NFL handles retired players. What are your feelings on, you know, about the NFL and their treatment of retired players?
Well, it's a travesty. It's a travesty, you know, but I also feel that the players are responsible for being letting it happen the way that it happened. And it's really the NFL has, you know, it provides an opportunity for all in the sporting football business. But our union, or the NFLPA, has really been a disservice to us. And most players, because I remember days the NFLPA would come in, guys leave, don't even go into the meeting to get the information, and they would be talking about benefits in the future and all those things. So in some of what has created that problem is that the NFLPA understands the cycle of players. They know that by the time a player would get an issue, table the issue, and it take root in the league, one, they're going to stymie it and block it enough to where as you can't get in momentum, but because you're in and out the league so quick that the history doesn't stay. So I might have the knowledge of things that are wrong with the system, but before I could actually go through the bylaws, get it tabled, have the people that's created the problem removed to fix it, I will be out of the game. That just works to the detriment of the players. As a player, I can name some specific things that were done and that are still today being done to players. As an example, the Reggie White settlement. I remember I was a player rep, and during when Reggie was about to sign that, I told Reggie not to sign it because he was signing away the player's ability of being able to take their goodwill intellectual property and their likeness and be able to earn for themselves revenue. The NFL and the NFLPA and Norman Brayman, who was the owner of the Philadelphia Eagles, filed a deposition as an objector to the settlement for the Reggie White settlement. And here's two of the main reasons he did. Out of the Reggie White settlement, he's the only owner that lost players to free agency. Reggie and Keith Jackson, no other team lost any players. Under the gentleman agreement supposedly they had amongst the owners, that no owner was going to bid on any other owner's players. They broke that. He then started divulging the things that purportedly being the president of NFL Properties, which was the NFL's licensing arm that started signing players directly to contracts that would allow us to get the revenue paid directly to us, that an endorser or someone that would want to produce the player in a promotion, the money came directly to us. In the global agreement, he, being Norman Brayman, said that he negotiated to pay the Players Association, $100 million under the table, and they would give up the rights of being able to bring deals or licensing opportunities to players. So they were going to get out of players' business. Now, why that's significant to me, which I don't think anyone has ever really challenged it, is that here's an owner that's filing a federal deposition of an objection, and he put in the document that he did that, what owner would purge themselves? And what happened in that process, it went before Judge Doty, and before I was an objector, and it was about 21 other objectors there. And before we could ever get in the room, Judge Doty brought Brayman in, told Brayman that he had agreed to the agreement and that he was going to have to live by it, and dismissed it and threw it out before any of the rest of us were able to even use his deposition as a premise of why this shouldn't go forward. Separated the process. Okay? Now, the second piece of it is that as being a player rep, we had never, ever seen that document, ever, when we were talking about the executive decisions that had to be made about the settlement. But here's how the document came to the table. I found it, and this is how I found it. Ralph Wilson, the owner of the Buffalo Bills, and I were represented by the same law firm named Dykema Gossett. Dykema Gossett in Detroit, Michigan, was the largest law firm in the state of Michigan. Dykema Gossett was the law firm that represented my licensed company, which I was the only player in the history of pro football or any sports to own 100% of a licensed business. I was a partner with the owners. I made merchandise and sold licenses and used player likenesses. So the law firm is representing me, and they're representing the owner, but I'm an objector, and he's the defender. So anytime you have that under the etiquette of law, you exchange files. My lawyer get all his files. This lawyer get all my files. That's how I found it. And when I brought it back to other guys that were on the executive committee, all of a sudden each one of these guys start getting deals, little side deals with the PA. And it still exists because that was their way of somewhat quieting what happened and then turn back around and say, Jerry Ball is crazy and what I'm saying isn't true. But I didn't create the document. I was smart enough to have Dyke McGossett as the law firm representing my licensed company, which had absolutely nothing to do with the settlement until I became the objector. And when I became an objector, then we're exchanging the information, and you could see. But if you were to look at the things over the years, even under Philly.com, you can go and see Norman Brayman's response. And Norman Brayman didn't sue the other owners. He sued the NFLPA. And the NFLPA's response was that it was ludicrous. How ludicrous is it for a billionaire to purge themselves? Why would you be a billionaire and want to give up your freedom by saying you did it, not that we did it as a group, that I negotiated it? So in that, there has always been this undercurrent of issue. If you look at the NFLPA right now, the thing that their bylaws used to say, and they cleaned it up because I brought it to the attention of some of the guys that are on the retired board that are now on the national NFLPA board for active and retired players, they've weaseled their way up into that structure, but I raised this issue with them. I said, how are we, a 501c6, as an organization, retired chapters are 501c6s, which is like a chamber of commerce, and the NFLPA in D.C. is a 501c3. How does that those bylaws decide what's going on over here with a C6? And then they start going back and trying to clean that up because it's like it's a thought with the retired player that they can go back to the NFLPA and get the same access that they did as an active player because they're paying union dues, which they just canceled, so whereas now everybody can become a part of the union for free. Why is that? Because here we are paying union dues to something that is not a union, but you're doing it through a chamber of commerce. So there are all kind of antitrust laws that are being broke. There are all kind of things like enormous. And enormous means it's where one guy that's a member or the president of, let's say, the chamber cannot benefit more than other members. Well, there's guys that are president of the retired chapters that are also representing players with concussion or workman's comp that are former players that are also on the board of the national at the national level, but they get they benefit, but there's no benefit to the player. So when you start looking at all of the things that we're entitled to, whether or not we're part of the retired chapter or not does not default the fact that our retirements, our benefits, and these things still belong to us. And because the NFLPA is in partnership with the owners, that's who manages the funds and the decisions. And here's probably the greatest travesty for all players, specifically linemen and those that have passed. When you look at the benefits, and the time that the benefits become available to the players is at the same time that the players are dying off. If you Google and see what the average lifespan of a defensive lineman and an offensive lineman is in the NFL, it's 55 and 58.
Yeah,
our retirement starts at 55.
Shorter than a normal person.
Excuse me?
Yeah. And, I mean, what do you think of the NFL's concussion settlement?
Well, the concussion part, you know, I will tell you, you know, I have not today chosen an attorney, hadn't went to be a part of the suit, because quite honestly, I understand that it's a potential for money, but to actually get the money they're talking about, I don't want that ailment. I don't want to be in that state, you know. But if I'm due it, I think that you should make it available to me while I'm alive, okay? And I don't think that, you know, the organization being the game, the league, be it owner side or player side, has done enough. I remember one conversation I had with the benefits office there in Baltimore. I was trying to do my line of duty, and I had just missed the window less than 30 days. Now, I played 13 years, but in 30 days, you tell me that I missed the window for following that, but it's on some misinformation that a guy tells me. But the guy makes one comment to me. His name is Sam Vincent, and I never forget it. If I ever have a chance to see him face to face, I'm going to let him know some things about himself. He makes the statement that, well, it's not like you're policemen. Okay? Now, this is the guy that's handling our benefits that's comparing what we're doing to policemen, so that he's taking a risk management assessment of saying, well, it's not like this. But then when this CTE comes out, I want to ask him, no, we're not policemen, but who else is facing this? Because these benefits is the same risk that all players have played under, that same risk, without this knowledge of truly the traumatic episodes that happen with players as they progress and move on. A lot of times it's mixed diagnosed, you know, some of the mental illnesses and depression and the way guys or faculties are. You know, it always gets thrown, oh, he's crazy, he's this. It's always in a dismissive fashion, but no one steps up to really understand that that game could have been the chief culprit in why that player functions like that, because no one has ever talked about CTE until this come up in the last 3 years. You know?
Yeah, and the thing that's amazing to me real quick, Jerry, is the fact that these guys, a lot of them, can't walk, and they can't even get disability.
Man, I have my own problems. I have a chopped block, and right now my knee, I walk every step in pain. I got nerve damages, you know, and I can tell you, you know, what we're really talking about is quality of life.
Yeah,
the NFL
right.
And the things that, you know, Gene Upshaw decided. Gene Upshaw, you know, again, you know, look, when Gene was alive, every time he walked in that room, he and I was always about to get in a battle, you know, because I would call him out on certain things. You know, I remember one time when they had recertified and was passing the Reggie White settlement. So Gene comes into Cleveland. Just so happened, I had just left Detroit being the player rep there, so it's now I'm the player rep. Leaving Detroit, now I'm in Cleveland, but it's still in the same cycle, so there hasn't been any re-elections, so I'm still getting all the data. So Gene comes in, he says, yes, 51% of the players that voted for it. And everyone in the locker room, we knew that the majority of our team did not vote, because everybody asked, did you vote? So we took a head count that day. And that head count meant that only 13 players voted, so you're saying 7 voted on the team with 55, and y'all passed that. But here's one of the other things that they did that only very few of us caught this. When they sent out the announcement for telling players that they had so much time to respond back and either say yay or nay or remain abstain from the vote, they had sent us a letter out that inside the letter, it had a date of March 25th, okay? And in that letter, it said that we had to respond by April 1st. But the postmark on the envelope said August 2nd. Huh. So here's a letter that on the inside says you have to respond to, but the postmark on the outside
said April 2nd, which was the day after the day they said you had to respond. That's the type of games that our player association has been playing with us. Here's another thing that, and here's one of the solutions I think. First of all, we need to go through and look at everyone that was a part of that Ready Right settlement. I'm talking about from the attorneys on down, and we need to look to remove them. And we need to ask them for job descriptions of the jobs that they're doing, because here's what's happening. Here you have labor issues that come up every so many years, but all of the changes that take place always happens in between. But more importantly, the revenue that's going into this one organization that DeMaurice Smith is the chairman of, it's the thing he does the least of, but that's where all his money comes from. And you know where it is? That's where all of the revenue comes in for the likenesses of the players. Most players don't understand that if it's eight or more players in a program, they don't have to pay the individual players. So let's say Frito-Lay or Pepsi comes to the NFLPA and say, hey, we want to get some players for a program, but we only want one in each market. Well, they sell it as a national campaign and use all 32 cities, and because it's 32 individual players, that exceeds the amount that they would be required to play at the individual, so all that revenue for that goes into the NFLPA. And then from that money, the salaries are being paid to DeMaurice, Clark Gaines, the Well Gosher girl, whose family was the Gosher firm that represented us, which is another crazy thing that happened during the time I'm a player rep. You know, we're sitting in Maui, which we should be having it on mainland, but the reason why they have it on Maui is because they don't want the players to really come and participate, because it's too hard to get families to Maui to go over there and voice your opinion. But here's what happens there. Well, Gosser comes and tells us that we have a bill for $8 million, but they hadn't done any new filings and there hadn't been any proceedings in a 12-month period of time, but our bill goes up to $8 million. 4 months later, the NFL tells Well, Gosser that we will settle this suit and pay y'all bill. We didn't pay that law bill, that legal bill from the Red and White settlement. The league paid it. So why wouldn't a law firm be sent? But here's the most tragic, the thing that really shows and reflects that there's an issue that needs to be addressed and go deeper with players is, Well, Gosh, it's the same law firm that was representing Major League Baseball and basketball. One of the two, I think it's baseball, but they didn't get the jacked up deal. But when you talk to Major League Baseball and basketball players from then to now, the first thing they say is, man, we ain't never doing a deal like y'all union did. Man, y'all got a bad deal. Now, how do the basketball and the baseball and hockey players know football players got a bad deal, but the football players hadn't recognized where that bad deal was created? It was created within our own house. The owners control our union. They're in partnership. And television and media really is not going to be the ones that break this, because that's their partner. Why would we lob a bomb on something that's already great for us? We got great advertising. We got the number one ratings. We got the top products in sports. Why would we blow that up? They're not. But there's just some things we need to do as players in taking care of our business that we don't. And part of it is removing leadership. And taking DeMaurice, and if he wants to represent the player, stay on the labor relations side. Get out of the licensing business, because that's not what you was hired for. He said, oh, I was hired to represent players. But really? Are you negotiating with Frito-Lay or Pepsi or any of that for any of the likeness use of the players? You're not, but you're getting the revenue that comes through that way. That's how you're getting paid the type of money you're getting paid. So those are just some critical things at high level, but detailed enough. Whereas if players would get serious and really attack it, they need to attack the facts. Not just talk that something is wrong because you think it's wrong. Know what's wrong.
Yeah, and you started Invictus Partners, I think a little bit because of this, a little bit of a player development plan. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, Invictus Partners, you know, it's a small boutique firm. I work with multinationals, governments, and helping them bring infrastructure and finance into their projects, infrastructure being power generation, roads, refineries, industrial facilities, warehouses, port, retail, in the process of finishing the fund with Cantor Fitzgerald, which is the largest private investment bank in the world. And what we're doing is a equity fund that would be looking for opportunities abroad, working with, again, multinationals in different sectors, oil and gas, probably being the strongest in construction, and some telecom and technology stuff as well.
Yeah. All right. So what do you think can be done? Is there anything that can be done, or do you think the NFL has just become so big that nothing can be done about it now?
Well, yeah, things can be done. You know, we have to really, first of all, everyone, I'll tell you to the science how well our union and the league understands where the players are in their ability of making change. Last year, I was at a NFL retired players meeting, and they knew that the guys that would be voting on the next CBA are juniors in high school right now.
Yeah.
Okay, so when you're thinking that, if they're thinking that far ahead, that means that right now we should be addressing the issues that we want to address in 5-6 years. Let's address them now. Let's table them now. Let's do the due diligence now so that we can make sure that when it's time to present, that we have already exhausted the knowledge that's required so that we can make an argument and make a better deal. And in that period of process, I believe that we have to be able to get between now and the next CBA where the active players and the retired players are in the same room, understanding that everyone is in the same boat. It doesn't matter that you active today. Tomorrow you will be a retired player. And today you have a say, but when you come over here, you won't be able to say anything about what's going on over there. So for us to be able to give them the history, give them the knowledge, and have them understand how the bylaws and how the structure of the organization keeps us in the dark. The NFLPA, the way it operates, if there are 50 issues for players to decide on, the players may only see 10 of them. The other 40 are being decided by administrators that really aren't looking at the best interest for the players. They're looking at the best deal that keeps the NFLPA with a slush fund, so that money keeps coming to keep those people employed, so that they can continue to get those salaries that, you know, really aren't warranted.
Yeah, go ahead, Matt.
No, I was just going to ask, you know, how do you raise awareness to these players to, you know, to get everybody in the same room?
How do you what?
Raise awareness to the players to, like you said, get the former players and the current players in the same room to let everybody know that, like you said, that you guys are all in the same boat. How do you go about getting more awareness out for the players to be on board with that?
Well, I don't think it's a matter. All the players there hasn't been any players ever saying they don't want to talk a deal between active and former players. That is only happening in the administrative office of the NFLPA. The NFL has taken their hand off and told the NFLPA, that's y'all issue. We're going to give you these funds and y'all figure out what you're going to do with it. But they really hadn't given us anything. That's the problem.
Right.
Those things that they have, I guess you would say, shared with us are minuscule to what they should be. What the players have to do is take control of the communication where it can't be filtered by the NFLPA, so that when guys are sharing information, I'll come in and I'll say something. They'll run to the NFLPA to see if that's true. The NFLPA, if it goes against the grain or goes against the program, which is to keep it in the status quo, then that guy's crazy. They use a philosophy of saying that one player, you know, can voice an opinion, but it takes the group. So, like, if you have the rep for one team, he's going to speak for that group. So if he's not saying it, then it's discounted. Well, that group that they're talking about are the ones that are being offered the little sweetheart deals, getting invited on the trips, getting to participate in the things, getting to use the trust, which is supposed to be $100 million set aside for the players, which is a great thing. Now, don't get me wrong. There are some things that are good, but that is not enough, you know. And I'm not saying that every player that is involved in this process is doing things to the detriment of other players. I'm saying that they're operating in the dark and with a lack of knowledge of how they're being used as pawns to keep the other players down. Because here, as an example, they have what's called a trust. Have you guys heard of that?
Yeah.
Okay, the trust will pay for a player to go back to school, get a vocational. I've used it to go to theology school, or you can go back to college to get your degree. Great thing. But then, on the other hand, I see the trust moving around, and they're having these mixers, but in these mixers, they're just parties. When they're moving around with those mixers is when we should be as players talking to each other and really using that trust as a platform to truly get to the other players and share the information. But guys, you know, they decided, hey, we're going to just have mixers and let people know about the trust. Well, when we're there, there's no one there but the hired players from the NFLPA that's now, you know, I guess you say promoting the trust. That's some of the times that we could sit down and really have meetings versus, you know, just drinking and, you know, shooting the bull. You know, I came in to one for 10, 15 minutes, seeing what was going on. I'm like, waste of time. For me, not for them, those that, you know, want to still be Mr. Athlete and want to still be on stage or in the light, you know, perfect for you. But for what it's there for, that's squandering the opportunity. If there's $100 million, why don't we take $1 million of that and let's go hire some independent attorneys that don't have the NFL influence or the NFLPA influence just to break down the agreement and use two or three firms so that you can make sure you're getting consistent information and no one is swaying your decision or your idea of what's what. Take some of their resources and let's get that those agreements broke down. Let's do an audit of seeing how much money is being paid to the administrators and how much money is going to the players. You know, let's do a real audit on the things that are of real concerns so that the health benefits and the things that players really need are getting to them. You know, the one thing, being a guy that had a license, this is another thing. When I had that license, I was a part of the Sporting Goods Manufacturing Association. And the Sporting Goods Manufacturing Association actually keeps tab of all materials being sold through all retail. So during that time, the starter jackets were, this is before pro line, the starter jackets was the key jacket being sold with all NFL stuff, and Salem was doing the T-shirts and all that. So you could see exactly what revenue was being generated from NFL merchandise. And while we were negotiating the Reggie White settlement, the league was reporting to the players that there was only about a little bit more than $1 billion, $1.2 billion, or something like that, in revenue generated from the licensing, but the sporting goods manufacturing was reporting that it was $4 billion that was being generated just from NFL licensed material. But when they negotiated the Reggie White settlement, they shared it on the basis of designated revenue. So the league designated the revenue that they were going to share and then shorted how much they reported. Now, those are the things that, you know, that guys don't want to talk about. But then also, I'm one of the few, I'm the only player that was looking at that information. I had to show it to Howard Long, show it to Ronnie Lott, show it to Cornelius Bennett, Roy Woodson, you know. And here's another thing. Before they signed that agreement, and I won't put this gentleman out there because I don't know what strings the NFL has on. We know the NFL is an institution that got reached beyond what any of us could ever think. Just by the way they manipulate Minnesota's federal courts, you can see that.
Yeah.
But we had, that was a guy that was employed by the NFL at the very time that came to myself, Ronnie Lott, Howie Long, and a couple other players and told us that Gene was about to sign an agreement that would keep any other organization from being able to represent players in anything. So they were going to sign away, under a global agreement, our rights. And we were told that by NFL execs. And he told us right then, what y'all need to do right now is go out there and establish another company and grandfather before they put this in place. And we did it. It was called the Hitters Club. That's where the Hitters Club came from, after the quarterback club.
Yeah.
And that came from an NFL guy telling us of the bad deal that was being struck on us and gave us instructions how to make sure we could have a way of protecting the players. But I'm one of the few players that's bold enough to tell you what happened.
Well, see, I mean, the big difference here is this. The Major League Baseball and the NFL, the big difference is Marvin Miller was there to look out for the baseball players. It sounds to me like, from everything I've heard from more than just you, Gene Upshaw was out to get himself rich.
I would tell you, Gene, you know, I hope he's in heaven, but I would tell you, if it was based on what he did, you might not see, and I'm not saying that in a bad way, but, you know, he did that.
Hey, we're almost out of time. You want to tell everybody about where they can find out about your business, Invictus Partners?
Well, it's Invictus Partners. You know, my website is InvictusPartners.com. Do a level capital raise, and, you know, if anyone's, check out the website, contact information there. If you need any of those services, give us a call. And I'll be honest with you, I don't really promote most of my business at this point. It's word of mouth. I've been doing this over 20, 25 years. I was a partner in a consulting firm while I was playing. So really not just promoting just to get everybody to come through the door.
Yeah. All right, Matt, you got anything for Jerry?
Well, Jerry, it was an honor to have you on tonight. I appreciate you sharing your story. Like you said, you know, not a lot of people will be willing to share the things that you know. I appreciate you sharing that with our listeners, and wish you the very best in your business and all of your ventures.
Thank you, sir. And when are you guys going to run it?
It will be on probably within a half hour after we get off here.
Okay.
And we will share it to your page.
All right.
We share everything all over the place. So.
Well, I pick you up on the page on Facebook. But,
yeah.
You know, I appreciate the opportunity. And, hey, you know, if there's any other thing I can do, any other player you want to talk to, I might be able to point you to some interesting commentary.
Okay, I got your number here. You mind me giving you a call sometime?
No problem.
All right. Hey, thanks a lot, Jerry. I want to remind everybody you can catch us on thegruelingtruth.net. You can catch us on Google Music, iTunes, Spreaker, Stitcher, just about any place that carries podcasts. Follow us at Grueling Truth. Matt, any final words?
This just goes to show, you know, more and more players have said a lot of the same things. And you know, it's gonna take a lot to get things turned around, but it starts with first just spreading awareness. And
career.
You know, I'd really like to see former players get representation that they deserve.
Yeah, and I mean, the problem is it's a big corporation, and like any billion-dollar corporation in this country or anywhere in the world, they pretty much get to do whatever they want because, you know, the governments and everything just turn their blind eye to it and everything, and they're just worried about, I mean, come on, they were a 501c for how many years up until the last year or so? So, I mean, that'll tell you right there that they had pretty much everything. I think they got the 501c back in like the mid-60s or so. So
yeah.
I mean, it's unreal.
Yep, but they say the value of the league is at $62 billion or more now.
Wow.
Yeah. And the fact that they can't take care of the Roman Gabriels, the Eddie Medders, I mean, the guys that built that empire for them, it would not hurt them at all to take care of those guys.
Just take care of the players.
Not at all. Not at all.
And it's sickening. And I'll tell you, the more that we've done this, we've probably interviewed 100 to 150 players in the last year. And just the stories we hear, and I mean, and then it's just like the other day, I'm not going to say who the player was, but it was a quarterback back in the 60s and 70s that I really wanted to interview. I actually got through to somebody that knew him, and he's like, he can't do it. I mean, he's been deteriorating for years. I mean, is the NFL helping? No. He's got a pension of $1,200 a month.
Right.
I mean, it's a joke. And, I mean, they're going to make they've turned the NFL draft into making millions of dollars for themselves, or billions of dollars even. The freaking draft.
They could just use the NFL draft, the money that they could get from that, to help the players. Just the draft.
Well, we appreciate you guys and what you're doing. You know, please help us keep getting that message out because it's needed. And it might not benefit us today, but it'll help those guys in the future if they just had the information.
Well, most definitely. I appreciate the kind words. And like I said, I'll call you here in a little bit and we'll see what we can do there. But thanks a lot, Jerry. So for Jerry Ball, Matt Andrews Gavage, I'm Mike Goodpasser. You've been listening to The Grueling Truth, where the legends speak.